She would return alone. Now, she would always be alone. Chapter 10 Guinevere, watching the preparations in the hall, hearing Bishop Patricius's soft voice saying, "No man may come to the Father except he call upon my name," looked on the cup with mixed emotions. Half of her said, "This beautiful thing should be dedicated, as Patricius wishes, to the service of Christ. Even the Merlin has come at last to the cross." But the other half of her insisted, quite against her will, "No, it would have been better to destroy it, to melt down the gold, if need be, and fashion from it another chalice, dedicated from its first making to the true service of the true God. For this one is of the goddess, as they call her, and that same goddess is that great harlot who has from the beginning of time been the enemy of God. Truly, the priests say, with woman came evil into this world." And then she was confused, for surely not all that is woman can be evil. Even God chose a woman to bear his son, and Christ himself spoke of heaven to his chosen disciples and their sisters and wives. One at least had forsaken that goddess. She felt her face soften as she looked on Nimue, Elaine's daughter, and very like Elaine as a child, but even more beautiful, with something of the smiling gaiety and dancing grace of the younger Lancelot. So fair and sweet was Nimue, she couldn't believe anything of her was evil. Yet this woman had served since childhood in the very house of the goddess. And now she had repented of that evil service, and come to Camelot, begging that no one should know that she had served in Avalon, not even Bishop Patricius, not even Arthur. It would be hard, Guinevere thought, to refuse Nimue anything at all. She had willingly pledged herself to keep the young maiden's secret. She looked past Nimue to where Patricius was standing, ready to take the cup with his hands. And then it seemed to Guinevere that a great angel, wings falling away in shadow behind the shining form, raised between its hands a cup that glowed like a great shining star. It was crimson like a beating heart, a glowing ruby. No, but it was the very blue of the deepest heaven, and there was a scent like all the roses of every garden she had ever entered in all her life. And a great, clean-scented wind seemed suddenly to blow through the hall, and though they were at holy service, Guinevere suddenly felt that she could rise from her seat and run out of doors on the hills, into the great spaces which belonged to God, under his great, wide, healing sky. She knew deep within her heart, that she would never again be afraid to leave the prison of chamber and hall. She could walk under the open sky and on the hills without fear, because wherever she might go, God would be with her. She smiled, disbelieving she heard herself laugh aloud, and the small, once prisoned thing within her asked angrily, "At holy service?" But the real Guinevere said, still laughing, though no one heard, "If I may not take delight in God, then what is God to me?" And then, through the sweet scents and joy, the angel was before her and the cup at her lips. Shaking, she drank, lowering her eyes. But then she felt a touch on her head and looked up, and she saw that it wasn't an angel, but a woman veiled in blue, with great sad eyes. There was no sound, but the woman said to her, "Before Christ ever was, I am, and it was I who made you as you are. Therefore, my beloved daughter, forget all shame and be joyful, because you, too, are of the same nature as myself." Guinevere felt that her whole body and heart were made of pure joy. She hadn't been as happy as this since she was a little child. Even in Lancelot's arms she had never known this absolute bliss. "Ah, could I only have brought this to my lover? She knew that the angel, or whatever presence had touched her, had moved on, and she was saddened that it had withdrawn. But the joy was still pulsing inside her, and she looked up with love as the angel held the burning cup to Lancelot's lips. "Ah, if only she can give you some of this joy, my sorrowing lover." The fiery flames and the rushing wind filled the hall and were silenced. Guinevere ate and drank, although she never knew what it was, only that it was sweet and savorous, and she gave herself up to the delight of it. "Surely, whatever has come among us today, it is holy." Silence fell on the hall. It seemed bare and empty in the pale noonday, and Gawain had risen, crying out, and after him Galahad. "I swear that I shall spend all my life, if need be, till I see the Grail clear before me." Bishop Patricius looked faint, and she remembered that he was old, and the altar where the cup had lain was empty. She rose swiftly from her place and went to him. "Father," she said, and held a cup of wine to his lips. He sipped, and as the colour began to come back into his lined face, he whispered, "Surely something holy has come among us. I was fed truly at the Lord's table by the very cup from which he drank on that last holy night before he went to his passion." Guinevere was beginning to know what had happened. Whatever had come to them that day by God's will was a vision. The bishop whispered, "Did you see, my queen, the very cup of Christ?" She said gently, "Alas, no, dear father. Perhaps I wasn't worthy for that. But I saw an angel, I think. And I thought for a moment it was God's holy mother who stood before me."
"God has given us each a vision," said Patricius. "How I have prayed that something might come among us to inspire all these men with the love of the true vision of Christ."
Guinevere thought of the ancient proverb, "Have a care what you pray for, it might be given you." Surely something had inspired these men. One after another they were rising, pledging to spend a year and a day searching, and she thought, "All of the round table now is scattering to the four winds." She looked at the altar where the chalice had lain. "No," she thought, "Bishop Patricius and Kevin the Merlin, you were wrong as Arthur was wrong. You cannot call down God to serve your own purposes this way. God blows through human purposes like a mighty wind, like the rush of angels' wings, which I heard in this hall this day, and tears them asunder." And then she wondered, "What is wrong with me, that I am thinking to criticize Arthur or even the bishop for what they did?" Yet then, with a new strength, she thought, "By God, yes. They are not God. They are only men, and their purposes are not sacred." She looked at Arthur, walking now among the peasants and subjects at the far end of the hall. Down there something had happened. Some peasant had fallen down dead, perhaps overfilled with the joy of the Holy Presence. He came back, looking sorrowful.
"Gawain, must you go? Galahad, not you too, my son. Bors, Lionel, what, all of you?"
"My lord Arthur," called out Mordred.
He wore, as always, the crimson which suited him so well, and which exaggerated almost to the point of caricature his likeness to the young Lancelot. Arthur's voice was gentle.
"What is it, my dear boy?"
"My king, I ask your permission not to go on this quest," he said. "Though it may be laid on all your knights, someone must remain at your side."
Guinevere felt an overflowing tenderness for the young man. "Oh, this is Arthur's true son, not Galahad, all dreams and visions." Had there ever been a time when she had disliked and distrusted Mordred? She said, heartfelt, May God bless you, Mordred. And the young man smiled at her. Arthur bowed his head and said,
Be it so, my son.
It was the first time Arthur had called him so before other men. Guinevere gauged his disturbance by that.
God help us both, Gwydion. Mordred, I should say, with so many of my companions scattered to the four corners of the world, and God alone can say whether or no they will ever return.
He reached out and clasped Mordred's hands, and for a moment it seemed to Guinevere that he leaned on his son's strong arm. Lancelot came to her side and bowed.
Lady, may I take my leave of you?
It seemed to Guinevere that tears were as near the surface as joy. Oh, love, must you go on this quest? And cared not who heard her speak the words. Arthur, too, looked troubled, holding out his hand to his cousin and friend.
Will you leave us, Lancelot?
He nodded. There was something rapt, otherworldly, shining in his face. So it had come to him, too, that great joy. But why, then, did he need to go forth to seek it? Surely it was within him as well. All these years, my love, she said, have you told me that you are none so good a Christian as all that? Why, then, must you run away from me on this quest? She saw him struggling for words, and at last he said,
All those years I knew not whether God was nothing but an old tale told by the priests to frighten us. Now I have seen.
He wet his lips again with his tongue, trying to find words for something beyond them.
I have seen something. If a vision such as this can be shown, whether of Christ or of the devil,
surely, interrupted Guinevere. Surely it came of God, Lancelot.
So you say, for you have seen. You know, he said,
holding her hand against his heart.
I am not sure. Methinks my mother mocked at me, or all gods are one, as Taliesin used to say. I am torn now between the darkness of never knowing and the light beyond despair, which tells me...
And again he fumbled for words. It was as if a great bell called to me, far away. A light... like to the faraway lights in the marsh, saying, Follow. And I know that the truth, the real truth, is there, there, just beyond my grasp, if I can only follow it, and find it there, and tear away that veil which shrouds it. It is there, if only I can reach it, my Guinevere. Would you deny me the search, now that I know there is truly something worth the finding? It seemed as if they were alone in a room, not in the court, before all men. She knew she could prevail on him in all else, but who can come between a man and his soul? God had not seen fit to give him this sureness and joy, and she didn't wonder that he must now go seeking for it. For if she had sensed it was there, yet without the surety, she too would have spent the rest of her life in that seeking. She reached both hands to him and said, feeling as though she embraced him before all men in the clear light of day, Go then, my beloved, and God reward your search with the truth you seek. And he said,
God remain with you always, my queen, and may he grant that some day I return to you.
Then he turned to Arthur, but Guinevere didn't hear what they said. Only that he embraced Arthur as he had done when they were all young and innocent. Arthur stood, his hand on Guinevere's shoulder, watching him go. I think, he said softly, that Lance is the best of us. And she turned to him, her heart overflowing with love for this good man who was her husband, and said, I think so too, my dearest love. He said, surprising her,
I love you both, Gwen. Never think, never, that you are less to me than anything on earth.
"I'm almost glad you have never borne me a son," he added, almost in a whisper,
"for then you might think I loved you only for that. And now I can say to you, I love you beyond all else, save only my duty to this land, whereof God has given me the stewardship. And you cannot be jealous of that."
"No," she said softly.
And then, for once, meaning it absolutely, without reservation, she said,
"And I love you too, Arthur. Never doubt that."
"I have never for a moment doubted that, my own dear love." And he raised both her hands to his lips and kissed them. And Guinevere was filled again with that great and overflowing joy.
What woman alive has had so much of life that the two greatest men within the borders of this world have loved me?
All around them the noises of the court were rising again, demanding notice for the things of everyday life. Everyone, it seemed, had seen something different. An angel, a maiden bearing the Grail. Some, like herself, had seemed to see the Holy Mother. And many, many others had seen nothing, nothing but a light too bright to bear, and had been filled with peace and joy, and been fed with such meats and drinks as they liked best. Now a rumour was going about that by the favour of Christ what they had seen was the very Grail from which Christ had drunk at the Last Supper among his disciples, where he broke the bread and shared the wine, as if it were body and blood of the ancient sacrifice. Had Bishop Patricius chosen his moment to spread that tale, while they were all confused, and no man knew precisely what he had actually seen?
"There was a tale," Morgaine had told her, Guinevere remembered, crossing herself. "Jesus of Nazareth," they said in Avalon, "had come here in youth to be educated among the wise Druids in Glastonbury. And after his death, his foster father, Joseph of Arimathea, had come here and struck his staff into the ground where it had blossomed into the holy thorn. Did it not then seem reasonable that this same Joseph had brought hither the cup of the sacrifice? Surely, whatever passed, it was holy. Surely this was a holy thing, since if it hadn't come of God, it couldn't be anything but a most evil enchantment. And how could such beauty, such joy, be evil?"
Yet whatever the bishop said, it had been an evil gift, Guinevere thought, shaking. One by one the companions had arisen and ridden forth on their quest, and now she looked on a hall which was all but empty. They were gone, all the companions, save for Mordred, who had vowed to remain, and Kai, who was too old and lame to ride forth. Arthur turned away from Kai. She knew he must be comforting Kai for not riding on this quest with the others. And he said,
"Ah, I too should have ridden forth with them. But I could not. I would not shatter their dream."
She came and herself poured him some wine, and she wished suddenly that they were within their own rooms, not here where they were left alone in the hall of the Round Table.
"Arthur, you planned what happened.
You told me that something amazing was being planned for Easter."
"Yes," he said, leaning back wearily in his chair. "But I swear to you that I knew not what was planned by Bishop Patricius, or by the Merlin. I knew that Kevin had brought here the holy regalia from Avalon."
He laid a hand on his sword.
"I was given the sword at my crowning, and now it has been given to the service of this kingdom and of Christ. It seemed to me, as the Merlin said, that the holiest of mysteries of the ancient world should be put to the service of God, since all the gods are one, as Taliesin always told us. In the old days the Druids called their god by other names, but these things belong to God, and should be given to him. Yet I know not what happened in the hall this day."
"You know not? You?
Does it not seem to you that we beheld a true miracle, that God himself came before us to show that the Holy Grail should be reclaimed for his service.
At times, I think so, said Arthur slowly. And then I wonder, was it not the magic of the Merlin which enchanted us, so that we should see a vision and think thus? For now are my companions gone forth from me, and who knows whether they shall ever return.
He raised his face to her. She noticed, as from very far away, that his eyebrows were all white now, and that his fair hair was liberally silvered. He said,
Knew you not that Morgaine was here?
Morgaine? Guinevere shook her head. No, I knew it not. Why came she not to greet us?
He smiled. You ask that. She left our court under my great displeasure.
His lips tightened, and again his hand sought the hilt of Excalibur, as if to reassure himself that still it lay at his side. It hung now in a leather scabbard, a coarse and ugly thing. She had never dared to ask him what had become of the one Morgaine had made for him so many years ago. But now she guessed that was behind their quarrel.
You knew it not, that she had rebelled against me. She would have put her paramour Accolon on the throne in my place.
Guinevere had thought she would never again feel wrath at any living creature after the day's joyous vision. Even now what she mostly felt was pity for Morgaine, and pity too for Arthur, knowing how he had loved and trusted the sister who had betrayed him. "Why did you not tell me that? I never trusted her."
"That is why," said Arthur, pressing her hand. "I thought I couldn't bear it, to hear you say how you trusted her never, and how you had often warned me against her. But Morgaine was here this day in the guise of an old peasant woman. She looked old, Guinevere, old and harmless and sick. I think she had come in disguise for another look, perhaps, at that place where once she had held high state, and perhaps for another glimpse of her son. She looked older than our mother looked when she died."
And he was silent, reckoning for a moment on his fingers, and saying at last,
"Why, and so she is, as I am older than my father ever was, my Guinevere. I think not Morgaine came to do mischief, and if she did, why, for sure it was prevented by the holy vision."
And he was silent. Guinevere knew with her sure instinct that he didn't want to say aloud that he loved Morgaine still, and that he missed her. "As the years pass, there are so many things I cannot say to Arthur, or he to me. But at least we both spoke today of Lancelot, and of the love that was among us all." And it seemed to her, for the moment, that this love was the greatest truth in her life. And that love could never be weighed out or measured. So much for this one, and so much for that. But was an endless and eternal flow, that the more she loved, the more love she had to give, as she gave it now to everyone, as it had been given to her by her vision. Even toward the Merlin today she felt that flow of warmth and tenderness. "Look how Kevin struggles with his harp. Shall I send someone to help him, Arthur?" Arthur smiled and said,
"He needs it not, for Nimue is ministering to him, see?"
And again she felt the flood of love, this time for Lancelot's daughter and Elaine's, child to two of those she had loved best. Nimue's hand under the Merlin's arm. Like the old tale of the maiden who fell in love with a wild beast from the depths of the forest. Ah, but today she even felt love for the Merlin too, and was glad that he had Nimue's strong young hands to help him. And as the days passed in the near empty court at Camelot, Nimue came to seem more and more like the daughter she had never had. The girl listened with attentive courtesy when she spoke, flattered her subtly, was ever quick to wait upon her hand and foot. Only in one thing did Nimue displease Guinevere. She spent far too much time listening to the Merlin. "He may now call himself Christian child," the queen warned, "but at heart he is an old pagan, sworn by the barbaric rites of the Druids, which you have renounced. You can see still the serpents he wears on his wrists." Nimue stroked her own satiny wrists.
"Why, so does Arthur," she said gently. "And I too might have worn them, cousin, had I not seen the great light. He is a wise man, and there is no man in all Britain who can play more sweetly upon the harp."
"And there is the bond of Avalon to bind you," said Guinevere, a little more sharply than she intended.
"No, no," said Nimue. "I beg of you, cousin, say this never to him. He didn't see my face at Avalon. He knows me not. And I do not wish him to think me an apostate from that faith to this."
She looked so troubled that Guinevere said lovingly,
"Why, if you wish, I will not tell him. I haven't told even Arthur that you came to us from Avalon. And I am so fond of music and of the harp," Nimue pleaded. "May I not speak with him?"
Guinevere smiled indulgently.
"Your father, too, was a fine musician. Once he said that his mother had set a harp in his hand for a plaything before he was old enough even to hold a toy sword, and taught him to touch the strings. I would like the Merlin better if he stayed with his harp and sought not to be one of Arthur's counsellors."
Then she shuddered and said,
"To me the man is a monster."
Nimue said patiently,
"I am sorry to see you so against him, cousin. It isn't his doing. I am sure he would rather be as handsome as my father and as strong as Gareth."
Guinevere bent her head.
"I know it isn't charitable of me, but from childhood I've had a revulsion for those who are so misshapen. I'm not sure it wasn't the sight of Kevin which caused me to miscarry when last I had a chance to bear a son. And if God is good, does it not follow that what comes from God must be beautiful and perfect, and what is ugly and misshapen must be the work of the foul fiend?"
"No," said Nimue. "It seems not at all likely to me. God himself sent trials to the folk in Holy Writ, for he afflicted Job with leprosy and boils, and he caused Jonah to be swallowed up by a great fish. And again we are told he made his chosen people to suffer, and even Christ himself suffered. One might say that these people suffer because it is the will of God that they shall suffer more than others. It may be that Kevin suffers this affliction for some great sin he did in some life before this one. Bishop Patricius tells us that is a heathen notion, and no Christian should believe that abominable lie, that we are born and reborn again. Or how should we ever go to heaven?"
Nimue smiled, remembering Morgaine saying to her, "Never speak to me again of anything Father Griffin said to you." She thought she would like to say it now to Guinevere, but she kept her voice gentle.
"Oh, no, cousin, for even in Holy Scripture it is told how men asked of John the Baptizer who he was. Some men said that Jesus Christ was Elijah come again, and he said instead, 'I tell you that Elijah has come among you already, and ye knew him not.' And men knew, so it says in Holy Writ, that he spoke of John. And so, if Christ himself believed that men were reborn, how can it be wrong for mankind so to believe?"
Guinevere wondered how so much knowledge of Scripture had come to Nimue, living upon Avalon. And she remembered that Morgaine, too, had known more, she sometimes thought, of the holy writings than she herself did.
Nimue said, "I think perhaps the priests do not want us to think of other lives, because they wish us to be very good in this one.
Many priests think there isn't much time remaining before the world will end and Christ come again. And so they are afraid that men will wait for another life to be good and will not have time to attain perfection before Christ comes. If men knew they would be reborn, would they work so hard to be perfect in this life?
That seems to me dangerous doctrine, Guinevere said. For if people believe that all men must at last be saved in some life or other, what would keep them from committing sins in this one, in the hope that at last God's mercy would prevail?
I do not think that fear of the priests or of God's wrath, or anything else, will ever keep mankind from committing sins, said Nimue. But only when they have gained enough wisdom in all their lives, that they know error is useless and evil must be paid for, sooner or later.
Oh, hush, child, Guinevere said. Suppose someone should hear you speaking such heresies.
Although it is true, she said, after a moment, that since that day of Easter, it seems to me that there is infinite mercy in God's love, and perhaps God doesn't care so much about sin as some of the priests would have us believe. And now I am talking heresy too, perhaps.
Nimue only smiled again, thinking to herself, I didn't come to court to bring enlightenment to Guinevere. I have a more perilous mission, and it is not for me to preach to her the truth, that all men, and all women too, must one day come to enlightenment.
Do you not believe Christ will come again, Nimue?
No, thought Nimue, I do not.
I believe that the great enlightened ones, like Christ, come but once, after many lives spent in attaining wisdom, and then they go forth forever into eternity. But I believe the divine ones will send other great masters to preach the truth to mankind, and that mankind will always receive them with the cross and the fire and the stones.
What I believe doesn't matter, cousin.
What matters is the truth. Some priests preach that their God is a God of love, and others that he is evil and vengeful. Sometimes I feel that the priests were sent to punish people. Since they would not hear Christ's words of love, God sent them the priests with their message of hatred and bigotry.
And then she stopped short, for she didn't want to anger Guinevere.
But the queen only said, Well, Nimue, I have known priests like that.
And if some priests are bad men, said Nimue, I find it not wholly beyond reason that some druids might be good ones.
There must, thought Guinevere, be some error in that reasoning, but she couldn't make it out.
Well, my dear, you may be right, but it makes me queasy to see you with the Merlin.
Although I know Morgaine thought well of him. It was rumoured here at court, even, that they were lovers. I wondered often how a woman so fastidious as Morgaine could have let him touch her.
Nimue hadn't known that, and she thrust it away in her mind for reference. Was that how Morgaine had known of his undefended fortresses? She said only, Of all I learned in Avalon, what most I loved was music, and what I have heard in Holy Writ that pleases me most was the psalmist who told us to praise God with the lute and the harp. And Kevin has promised me that he will help me to find a harp, for I came away without my own. May I send for him here, cousin?
Guinevere hesitated, but she couldn't resist the sweet entreaty in the young girl's smile, and said, To be sure you may, my dearest child.
Chapter 11. After a time, the Merlin came.
No, thought Nimue, I must remember he is no more now than Kevin the Harper, traitor to Avalon, and behind him a servant carrying my lady. Nimue thought, Now he is a Christian, there is no law that no other may touch his harp.
It is simpler than keeping an initiated man about him to bear my lady when his strength fails.
He walked with two sticks, dragging his tortured body after them. But he smiled at the ladies and said,
"You must consider, my queen and my lady Nimue, that somehow my spirit has made to you the courtly bow that my unruly body is no longer able to make."
Nimue whispered, "I beg you, cousin, ask him to sit. He cannot stand for long."
Guinevere waved permission, glad for once of her near sight. That meant she needn't clearly see the misshapen body.
For a moment, Nimue was afraid that Kevin's man was from Avalon and would recognize and perhaps greet her. But he was only a servant in the dress of the court. How had Morgaine, or old Raven, been able to see so far ahead to order her as a child into seclusion, so that when she came to womanhood, there would be one fully trained priestess in Avalon whom the Merlin would not know by sight? She understood that she was merely a pawn in the great work of the world, sent forth with no weapons but her beauty and her guarded virginity, to work the vengeance of the goddess on this man who had betrayed them all. Nimue placed another cushion from her own chair under the Merlin's arm. His bones seemed to protrude through the skin, and when she barely touched his elbow, it seemed that there was so much heat in the swollen joints that it burned her. And she felt a moment's pity and rebellion. Surely the goddess already works her own vengeance. This man has surely suffered enough. Ere Christ suffered a day on the cross, this man has been crucified in his broken body for a lifetime. Yet others had been burned for their faith, and hadn't broken, nor betrayed the mysteries. She hardened her heart and said sweetly,
"Lord Merlin, will you play your harp for me?"
"For you, my lady," Kevin said in his rich voice. "I will play what you will. And I could wish I were that ancient bard who could play till the trees danced."
"Oh, no," said Nimue with mocking laughter. "What would we do if they came dancing in here? Why, we would have earth all over the hall, and all our maids with mops and brooms wouldn't be able to clean it. Leave the trees where they are, I beg you, and sing."
The Merlin put his hands to the harp and began to play. Nimue sat beside him on the floor, her great eyes looking up, intent, into his face. The Merlin looked down on the maiden, just as a great dog might watch its master, with humble devotion and utter preoccupation. Guinevere took such emotion almost for granted. She herself had been the object of intense devotion so often that she never thought twice about it. It was simply the homage that men paid to beauty. Perhaps, though, she should warn Nimue, lest her head be turned by it. Yet she couldn't imagine how Nimue could sit so close to his ugliness, or look at him so attentively. There was something about Nimue that puzzled Guinevere. Somehow, the girl's concentration was not quite what it seemed. It wasn't the delight taken by one musician in another's work, nor was it the artless admiration of a naive maiden for a well-travelled and mature man. No, thought Guinevere. And it wasn't a sudden passion, either. That she could have understood, and in a sense sympathised with. She herself had known that sudden, overpowering love which sweeps away all obstacles. It had struck her like lightning, and had ruined all her hopes that her marriage with Arthur could be a good and proper one. It had been a curse. Yet she had known it was something that came of itself, over which neither she nor Lancelot had any power. She had come to terms with it, and she could have accepted that it had happened to Nimue, even though Kevin the Merlin seemed the most unlikely object for such a passion. But it wasn't that. She didn't know how she knew, but she knew. Simple lust? It might have been that on Kevin's part,
Nimue was beautiful, and even though the Merlin had been most circumspect, she might have kindled any man. But Guinevere couldn't believe that Nimue had been likewise roused by such a one, when she had remained courteous, but cool and unattainable, to all of Guinevere's handsomest young knights. From where she sat at the Merlin's feet, Nimue sensed that Guinevere was watching her. But she didn't turn her eyes away from Kevin. "In a way," she thought, "I am enchanting him." Her purpose demanded that she have him completely at her mercy, her slave and her victim. And again she stifled the flash of pity that she felt. This man had done worse than simply revealing the mysteries or the secret teaching. He had given the holy things themselves into the hands of the Christians to be profaned. Ruthlessly, Nimue refused to consider her next thought, that the Christians hadn't intended profanation, but hallowing. The Christians knew nothing of the inner truths of the mysteries. And in any case, the Merlin had betrayed a sworn oath. And the goddess appeared to prevent that profanation. Nimue had had enough training in the mysteries to know what she had witnessed. Even now a shiver went over her at the thought of what had passed among the companions on that festival day. She hadn't wholly understood, but she knew that she had touched the greatest holiness. And the Merlin would have profaned this. No, he must die like the dog he was. The harp was silent. Kevin said, "I have a harp for you, lady, if you will accept it. It is one which I fashioned with my own hands when I was a lad on Avalon, and first come there. I have made others, and they are better, but this is a good one, and I have carried it long. If you will accept it, it is yours." Nimue protested that such a gift was all too valuable, but inwardly she was overjoyed. If she should possess something so valuable to him personally, something he had fashioned with his own hands and labour, then would it bind him to her just as if it were a lock of his own hair or a drop of his blood? There were not many, even in Avalon, who knew that the law of magic went so far that something which had been so intimately intertwined with the mind and the heart and the passions, and Nimue grasped that music was his deepest passion, retained even more of the soul than hair clipped from the body retained the essence of the body. She thought with satisfaction, "He himself, of his own free will, has put his soul into my hands." When he sent for the harp, she caressed it. Small and crudely made as it was, the post had been worn smooth with resting against his body, and his hands had touched the strings with love. Even now they lingered on it tenderly. She touched the strings, testing their music. In truth, the tone of the harp was good. He had somehow managed that perfect curve and structure that made the sounding board echo the strings with the sweetest tone. And if he had done this as a boy, with those mutilated hands. Again, Nimue felt the surge of pity and pain. Why did he not keep to his music and meddle not in the high affairs of state? "You are too kind to me." She let her voice tremble, hoping he would think it was passion instead of triumph. "With this, soon he will be mine, possessed body and soul." But it was too soon. The great tides of Avalon running in her blood told her that the moon was waxing. Such great magic as this could be worked only in moon dark, the slack time when the lady sheds none of her light on the world, and her hidden purposes are made known. She mustn't let his passion grow beyond bounds, nor her own sympathy with him. "He will desire me at full moon. This bond I am forging is a double-edged sword, a rope with two ends. I will desire him as well."
cannot prevent that. For an enchantment to be total, it must involve both enchanter and enchanted. And she knew, with a spasm of terror, that this spell she was weaving would work on her too, and rebound on her. She couldn't pretend passion and desire. She must feel them as well. She knew, with a fear that wrung her heart, that even as the Merlin would be helpless in her hands, so it might well be that she would come to be helpless in his.
And what of me, O goddess?
Mother, that is all too great a price to pay. Let it not come on me.
No, no, I'm afraid.
Well, Nimue, my dear, Guinevere said, now that you have the harp in your hands, will you play and sing for me?
She let her hair curtain her face as she looked timidly at the Merlin, and murmured,
Shall I, then?
I beg you to play, he said. Your voice is sweet, and I can hear that your hands will bring enchantment from the strings.
They will indeed, if I am favoured of the goddess.
Nimue set her hands to the strings, remembering that she mustn't play any song of Avalon that he would remember and recognise. She began to play a drinking song she had heard at the court, with words none too proper for a maiden. She saw Guinevere looking scandalised and thought,
Good. If she is shocked by my unmaidenly behaviour, she will not inquire too deeply into my motives.
Then she played and sang a lament she had heard from a northern harper, the mournful song of a fisherman out on the sea, looking for the lights of his home on the shore. At the end of the song she rose, looking shyly at him.
I thank you for the use of your harp. May I borrow it again, that my hands may keep their skill?
It is my gift to you, said Kevin. Now that I have heard what music your hands can bring from it, it could belong to no other. Keep it, I beg you. I have many harps.
You are too kind to me, she murmured. But I beg you, now that I can make music for myself, do not abandon me or deprive me of the pleasure of listening to yours.
I will play for you whenever you ask me, Kevin said, and she knew that his heart was in the words. She contrived to brush against him as she leaned forward to take the harp. She murmured softly, so Guinevere wouldn't hear,
Words alone cannot express my gratitude to you. Perhaps a time will come when I can express it more fittingly.
He looked at her, dazed, and she discovered that she was returning his gaze with the same intensity.
A double-edged spell indeed. I am victim too.
He went away, and she sat obediently by Guinevere, and tried to turn her attention to her spinning.
How beautifully you play, Nimue, said Guinevere. I need not ask where you learned. I heard Morgaine sing that lament once.
Nimue said, averting her eyes,
Tell me something of Morgaine. She had departed from Avalon before I came there. She was married to a king in Lothian, was it?
In the north of Wales, Guinevere began. Nimue, who knew all this perfectly well, was still not completely false. Morgaine remained a puzzle to her, and she was eager to know how the Lady Morgaine had appeared to those who knew her in the world.
Morgaine was one of my ladies-in-waiting, Guinevere was saying. Arthur gave her to me as such on our wedding day. Of course he had been fostered apart from her, and hardly knew her either.
As she listened attentively, Nimue, who had been trained to read emotions, realised that beneath Guinevere's dislike for Morgaine, there was something else, respect, awe, even a kind of tenderness. If Guinevere were not so fanatically, mindlessly Christian, she would have loved Morgaine well. At least, while Guinevere was talking of Morgaine, even though she condemned her as an evil sorceress, she was not mouthing the pious nonsense that bored Nimue almost to weeping. but she couldn't give Guinevere's tales her full attention. She sat in an attitude of passionate interest. She made the proper sounds of attention or astonishment, but within, her mind was in turmoil. I'm afraid. I can come to be the Merlin's slave and victim, as I would have him mine. Goddess, great mother, it is not I who must face him, but you. The moon was waxing, 4 nights until full, and she could already feel the stirring of that tide of life. She thought of the Merlin's intent gaze, his magical eyes, the beauty of his voice, and knew that already she was deeply entangled in her own spell-weaving. Already she had ceased to feel the slightest revulsion against his twisted body, feeling only the strength and life-force flowing within it. "If I give myself to him at full moon," she thought, "then will the tides of life within us both be taken at the flood. Then will my purposes become his own. Then will we blend together as one flesh." She felt an ache and agony of desire, longing to be caressed by those sensitive hands, feel his warm breath against her mouth. Everything in her ached together in hunger, which, she knew, was at least partly an echo of his own desire and frustration. The magical link she had created between them meant she too must be tormented with his torment. When life runs full at the rounding of the moon, then shall the goddess receive the body of her lover. It wasn't altogether beyond belief. She was the daughter of the queen's champion and the king's closest friend. Kevin, the Merlin, unlike a Christian priest, wasn't forbidden to marry. The court would be pleased at a marriage so high-placed, even though some of the ladies would be shocked that she could yield up her delicate body to a man they considered a monster. Arthur surely knew that Kevin could not, after what he had done, return to Avalon, but he had a place at court as the king's counsellor. Also, he was a musician of surpassing skill. "There would be a place for us, and happiness. When the moon is full, brimming with life, he will plant a child in my womb, and I will bear it joyfully. He is not monster-born. His deformity is from childhood injuries. His sons would be handsome." And then she stopped herself, disturbed by the power of her own fantasies. No, she mustn't become so deeply entangled in this spell. She must deny herself, even though the waxing moon made the surging blood in her veins a very agony of frustration. She must wait. Wait. If she had waited all those years. There is a magic that comes with yielding to life. The priestesses of Avalon knew it when they lay in the fields at Beltane, invoking the life of the goddess in their own bodies and hearts. But there is a deeper magic which comes from guarding the power, damming up the stream. The Christians knew something of this when they insisted that their holy virgins live in chastity and seclusion, that they might burn with the darker flame of that harnessed force, that their chaste priests might pour all their contained power into their mysteries, such as they were. Nimue had felt that power in the lightest word or gesture from Raven, who had never wasted words on anything trivial, so that her force, when she spent it, was tremendous. She had wondered often, alone in the temple at Avalon, when she was forbidden to mingle with the other maidens, or to go to the rites, when she felt that life force in her veins with such power that she sometimes burst into hysterical crying, or tore at her hair and her face, why had they set her aside for this? Why must she bear the terrible weight of all this without relief? But she had trusted the goddess, and obeyed her mentors, and now they had entrusted this great work to her, and she mustn't fail them through her own weakness. She was a charged vessel of power, like the holy regalia, which it was death to touch unprepared, and all this power of her long preparation would be hers to bind the Merlin to her. but she must wait for the tide to slacken and fill again. At the dark moon she must take the other tide, which came of the other side of the moon. Not fertile, but barren. Not of life at all, but of dark magic, older than human life. And the Merlin knew these things. He knew of the old curse of the dark moon and the barren womb. He must be so wholly enspelled by her that he wouldn't even wonder why she had refused him at the spring tide and sought him out at the slack. She had one advantage. He didn't know that she knew these things. He had never seen her in Avalon. Yet the bond went between them both ways. And if she could read his thoughts, he might read hers. She must guard herself every moment, lest he see within and guess her purposes. I must so wholly blind him with desire that he will forget all he has been taught in Avalon. And at the same time, she mustn't be overcome by his desire. She must contain her own. It wouldn't be easy. She began to frame in her mind the next wile she would use on him. "Tell me of your childhood," she would say. "Tell me how you were so hurt." Sympathy would be a powerful bond. She knew just how she would touch him with the very tips of her fingers. And she knew, in despair, that she was seeking out ways to be near him and touch him, not for her work, but for her own hunger. "Can I make this spell without bringing myself, too, to ruin?"
"You were not at the Queen's feast," murmured the Merlin, looking into Nimue's eyes, "and I had made a new song for you. It was the fulling of the moon. There is great power in the moon, lady."
She looked at him, all intent.
"Truly? Are you a magician, my Lord Merlin? I sometimes feel helpless that you are working your magic on me."
She had hidden herself at the full moon, sure that if he looked into her eyes at that time, he would be able to read her thoughts, and perhaps divine her purposes. Now that the strength of that magical tide was past, she could, perhaps, guard herself from him.
"You must sing me your song now."
She sat listening, feeling her whole body quiver as the harp strings quivered under his touch.
"I cannot bear it. I cannot. I must act this time as soon as the moon is dark."
Another of these tides, she knew, and she would succumb to the flood tide of hunger and desire she was building between them.
"And I would never be able to betray him. I would be his forever, for this life and beyond."
She reached out and touched the twisted lumps that were his wrist bones, and the touch thrilled her with longing. She could only imagine from the sudden dilation of his pupils, the swift intake of his breath, what it had done to him. "Betrayal," she thought, "under the inexorable laws of fate. Betrayal would be punished a thousandfold by the goddess, in life after life. Betrayed and betrayer would be punished and bound together for love and hate for thousands of years.
But she did this at the command of the goddess. She had been sent to punish a traitor for betrayal. Would she then be punished in turn?
If it were so, then there was no justice even in the realms of the gods.
Christ said true repentance wipes out all sin. But fate and the laws of the universe cannot be so easily set aside. The stars in their courses do not stop because someone cries out to them, 'Stop!'
Well, be it so. Perhaps she betrayed the Merlin as part of a deed done by one of them before the ancient land beneath the waves had sunk into the sea. It was her fate, and she dared not question. He had stopped playing and closed his hand softly over hers. As if in a daze, she laid her lips to his. Now it is too late to turn back.
No, it had been too late to turn back when she had bowed her head and accepted the work Morgaine laid on her.
It had been too late to turn back when she swore the oath to Avalon.